So that's the class webpage. Wait a minute, let me grab the mouse here so I can actually click things. That's the class webpage. It's currently got the PowerPoints from last week up on it. And I think I also put up links to a couple of other, one or two other relevant things. And I will continue to do that.
I have one question about it.
Yeah.
When it says Ollie 20, is there a space?
Yes. Ollie space 20 slash.
There's a space.
Yes, correct. It's generally been my policy in classes to start each class by asking if people have any questions about the last class. So I figured I should probably do that too here. So last class we were discussing Imperial Chinese law, Romani law, and Amish law. And before I go on to our new stuff for today, did people have any questions carried over from that? All right. What we want to do this time, assuming that we can squeeze it into the time, which I think I can, is Jewish law, Islamic law, and then two of my thread chapters, one of them being the problems that a legal system faces when God is the legislator, and the other being the special problems of embedded and polylegal systems. Embedded legal systems being a legal system like, say, Romani law in California at the moment, where you have some formal legal system which has got all of the physical power, and nonetheless people are trying to run their own legal system underneath it, enforcing it on their own people. And there are quite a lot of examples of such things, even in modern-day America, if you think about it for a while, and a variety of other historical examples. Polylegal systems are ones where the same territory has more than one legal system sitting on it. And that also exists in the modern world, although most of my examples will be not modern. All right. Let me run through a very brief history of what's relevant to Jewish law. Israel was a kingdom, an independent kingdom with its own legal system. It was conquered by the Babylonians in 586 B.C., became independent again with a revolt in 160 B.C., was then conquered by the Romans in 63 B.C., and ceased to be the effective center of Judaism when the Bar Kokhba revolt was suppressed in 136 A.D. And a lot of the population was either killed or enslaved. And in general, the center of Judaism as a culture and a legal system was no longer in Israel, although there were still people in Israel, of course. The interesting thing, though, for me, is that thereafter, the dispersed Jewish communities remained. They were under, after a while, once the Muslims and the Christians took over, they were under Christian or Muslim rulers, but most Jews were still under Jewish law. And the reason they were under Jewish law was that the non-Jewish rulers usually found that the easiest way of handling their Jewish subjects was to subcontract the job, to turn over the authority over their Jewish subjects to the Jewish communal authorities, who would then guarantee them a payment of taxes. And that was not universal, but a very common pattern in both Muslim and Christian places. And it occasionally broke down, the extreme case, of course, being Spain with the expulsion in 1492. Prior to that, when Spain was Muslim, it was a fairly hospitable place for the Jews. And in fact, it looks as though the Muslim authorities were willing to enforce Jewish law on Jews following the rulings of the Jewish authorities, even in cases where you would think it would not have been appropriate. We may go into that a little more, and if not, I do in the book. All right. So that Judaism was, in that sense, one version of an embedded legal system. You had a king whose authority ruled. Nonetheless, it was really the decisions that were being made by the communal authorities, not by him, that ruled. Some of you might be interested in a book by a Yale law professor called Order Without Law, which describes an embedded legal system about 2 hours from here. In Shasta County, California, where, by his account, certain legal issues are determined by the norms of neighborly behavior, even when they are inconsistent with the law of the state of California. The book is Order Without Law. It's quite a lot of fun. Anyway, not subject to this course, but something that's relevant to it. All right. Let me then point out some of the problems that Jewish law faced. And these are to some extent associated with the fact that it's based on divine revelation, or reports to be. And one of the problems is legal uniformity. that the law comes from Torah, from the first five books of the Old Testament, as interpreted by legal scholars. Judges are legal scholars. Suppose they disagree on their interpretation. There is no legislature. So therefore, you don't have the option of having the legislature revise the law to eliminate ambiguity. Truth is not determined by majority vote. So does that mean that what the law is depends on what judge you encounter? All right. Now, that's an issue in lots of other systems, that, for example, what the law is will depend on whether you end up in one state or court or another in the U.S., whether you end up in one federal district or not. The laws of different districts can differ, although in that case, if the difference is too much of a problem, the Supreme Court can eventually revise it. So how do they handle it? And the answer is that truth is not determined by vote, but law can be. And so the position in when Israel was a going concern was that the Greater Sanhedrin, which was a collection of high-level judges, their equivalent of the Supreme Court, could rule on interpretation. And the basis in the Torah for that was that the Torah said that in the case of doubt about the law, you should accept the views of the majority. And so they interpreted the views of the majority as meaning the majority of the legal scholars as represented by the Greater Sanhedrin. So the position was that did not determine what was true, but it determined how judges had to rule. That once the Sanhedrin had ruled, a scholar who disagreed could continue to argue for his position. He might persuade people later on, but he had to rule according to the majority rule. All right. Fairly early in the system, in the first century B.C., there developed two different schools of interpretation. They're associated with the names of Hillel and Shammai, who were sort of the leading figures in the first generation, but this went on for several generations. And they disagreed on the details of the interpretation, but for quite a while were willing to maintain essentially friendly disagreement, in which they were willing to eat at each other's tables, marry each other's daughters, even though they disagreed in detail on the legal rules relevant to what you could eat or who you could marry or things of that sort. But eventually the school of Hillel, which was the majority, effectively suppressed the school of Shammai. And that brings us to my very favorite Talmudic story, favorite partly because it's not at all clear how one should interpret it. And that is the story of the oven of Achnai. An object can become polluted. For example, if a dead body touches it, you can purify a polluted clay object by breaking it up. The question is, suppose you have a polluted oven, you break it up, and you then reassemble it with sand between the pieces. Is it still polluted, or have you now purified it? It is not probably a very important question, but all questions are ones which scholars can differ on. And Rabbi Eliezer, who was apparently a very high-status, respected scholar, associated more or less with the school of Shammai, took one position. I don't even remember which side he was on. And the sages of the school of Hillel took the other position, and they debated the question. R. Eliezer versus the sages. Eliezer offered powerful, convincing arguments for his position, but the sages were not convinced. And so Eleazar said, if I am correct, let this carob tree testify it. And the carob tree uproots itself and is flung 100 cubits away. Rabbi Yeshua, no proof can be brought from a carob tree. More arguments. Eleazar gives more arguments for his position. They still don't accept it. Then let this stream testify that I am correct. The stream turns around and starts flowing uphill. Yeah. Rabbi Yeshua, no proof can be brought from a stream. The argument continues. Finally, Eleazar says, let the meeting hall in which we stand testify that I am correct. And the walls of the meeting hall begin to lean inward. Rabbi Yeshua, to the meeting hall. It is not for you to interfere in the disputes of sages. Out of respect for him, the walls stop moving, and out of respect for Eleazar, they do not move back. More arguments. And finally, Eleazar said, let heaven testify that I am correct. And a voice from heaven says, why do you debate with Rabbi Eleazar, seeing that in all matters the halacha is in accord with him? That's the Jewish law. Rabbi Yahshua, it is not in heaven, or in other words, butt out. Isn't that a wonderful story so far? What happens? And this one I want to give you the whole story because it makes a good story. The sages put Eleazar under ban. I assume that means that he proposed to rule by his opinion as well as argue for it. Said they, who shall go and inform him? I will go, answered Ar-Akiba, lest an unsuitable person go and inform him and thus destroy the whole world. Arguing with God can be dangerous, right? What did Ar-Akiba do? He donned black garments and wrapped himself in black and sat at a distance of 4 cubits from him. And I think 4 cubits is as close as you're supposed to come to somebody under ban. I think that's what's going on. Akiba, said Ar-Eleazar to him, what has particularly happened today? Master, he replied, it appears to me that thy companions hold aloof from thee. Thereupon he too rent his garments, put off his shoes, removed his seat, and sat on the earth while tears streamed from his eyes. The world was then smitten, a third of the olive crop, a third of the wheat, and a third of the barley crop. Some say the dough in women's hands swelled up. Atana taught, great was the calamity that befell that day, for everything at which Ar-Eleazar cast his eyes was burned up. Rabbi Gamaliel, too, was traveling in a ship. He's the head of the Sanhedrin. When a huge wave arose to drown him, it appears to me, he reflected, that this is on account of none other but Rabbi Eleazar ben Hyrcanus. Thereupon he arose and exclaimed, Sovereign of the universe, thou knowest full well that I have not acted for my honor, nor for the honor of my paternal house, but for thine, so that strife may not multiply in Israel. At that the raging sea subsided. Rabbi Eleazar's wife is the sister of Rabbi Gamaliel. She forbids her husband to fall on his face in petitionary prayer. She gets distracted. He falls on his face in petitionary prayer. And from her brother's house comes the sound of the horn announcing his death. So how do you make sense of that story, right? That they're refusing to go along with what God tells them. And the result is a series of catastrophes. And apparently when Eleazar complains to God, God kills the head of the Sanhedrin for him. And I think there are two approaches to trying to understand that story. I'm not sure either is correct, I should say. Think about it from inside the belief system. From that system, God in the Torah said that in case of doubt, abide by the majority, which you interpret as the majority of the Sanhedrin. That means that God is giving humans the law, the task of interpreting the law, and therefore divine intervention is not legitimate in that task. And that makes a certain amount of sense. But then my puzzle is, why didn't the sages change their votes when God told them they were wrong? And yet they didn't. Now, of course, we don't know that any of this happened. This is a story, but it's supposed to be an instructive story, obviously. From outside the system, on the other hand, it makes more sense. Because if you have a system that's based on divine revelation, it's at risk from anybody who can convincibly claim to be divinely inspired, to be the channel for new revelation. And there are certainly examples in Jewish history and in Islamic history where you have somebody who maybe is a con man or maybe is really a holy saint or something, but who says, you know, God tells me such and such. And in order to defend against that threat, what you can see the story as being is saying, however strong the evidence is, it doesn't count. Not even a voice from heaven. So I think that's at least a plausible reading of what's happening. Whether correct, I don't know. Yeah.
I think a possible interpretation from within might be God is testing them. So it's like Abraham. Right? God says one thing, but he actually wants something else to happen.
In support of that, we are told that when this was happening, a certain prophet who was in a position to observe God was asked, what did God say during all of this? He laughed, he cried, he said, my children, they defeat me. So that would support that way of looking at it. Yeah. Yes?
I'm not sure I understand the argument completely. It would seem like a voice from heaven or any other supernatural indicator would be on the side of someone who claims a new revelation.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But what they're saying is, a voice from heaven might be fake after all. But if you think about the real world examples that we know about, you have somebody who can do what appear to be miracles. I'm thinking of a particular Islamic fairly prominent figure who either was a miracle worker or a con man. And we have a contemporary account by somebody who met him who basically said, I saw through how he was doing the trick, and he made it clear that I'd get killed if I told anybody. Uh-huh. And he then told people in his memoirs, basically. So if you say we can't trust the people in the future generations to distinguish true revelation, true divine intervention from false divine intervention, therefore we're going to establish the principle that divine intervention is never legitimate, however strong the evidence for it is. That's a possible way of reading what's going on. I don't know whether you're correct. The sort of final word on the Hillel versus Shammai controversy is supposedly that another heavenly voice says the words of both are the words of the living God, but the law is in accordance with the school of Hillel. To which I, in my skeptical nature, respond, how come they believe the voice from heaven that time? when it supports them. But in any case, you can see why I think it's a neat story. And it says sort of interesting and puzzling things about that system. All right, let me continue with the problem of uniformity as it continues through history, because the story I was telling you is back when there was still a Sanhedrin to make decisions. The Sanhedrin gave its last ruling in 358 A.D. After that, the Babylonian academies, there were two academies in Babylon, and they were thought of as sort of the most learned authorities. The Talmud, there are actually two Talmuds, but the Babylonian Talmud is the more authoritative of the two. But eventually the Babylonian academies were basically shut down by non-Jewish authorities, taken out of existence. And at that point, it shifts to various prominent scholars, so that at any given time, a judge somewhere in the diaspora will say, we all know that Moses ben Maimon, Maimonides, is the most learned scholar, we should ask him. That would be it for one point, at other times for the other ones. And they tended to divide geographically, so it might be that the French communities all agreed that one authority was most learned and the Spanish communities another, and so forth. Suppose you're a judge in the diaspora and you have a hard case. What do you do? You write it up. You send it to an authority you trust, say Maimonides, and eventually, it takes a long time because they had rather slow mail delivery at the time, but a year or two later, you get back a response where he says, this is what I believe the answer is to your puzzle. And these are referred to as responsa. They survive. There are apparently several hundred thousand of them that still exist, which is why one of the reasons why I suggest that Jewish law may be the best documented legal system of all past legal systems, because you've got the responsa, you've got a bunch of very large treatises by people like Maimonides and a bunch of other scholars, each of them hashing through in great detail what they think the implications of the law are. Of course, the different way of putting it is that my theory of why Jews were so prominent in scientific activity in the 19th century was that if you were a young Jewish man and you had the option of doing anything at all other than spending your life trying to make sense of the Talmud, you would leap on it. I should tell you that story. This is what I believe is the original of the story, which usually only appears in a debased version. A young man goes to the rabbi and he says, Rabbi, I've been trying to make sense of the work of Moses ben Maimon. I can't tell. He talks about the this tax and that tax. And what do I do? Do you know anybody who has a scroll of the Torah? Not necessarily the Torah, of the Mishnah. My uncle has a scroll of part of the Mishnah. Read that and come back to me in a week. Oh, Rabbi, this Mishnah is so convincing. This scholar says this answer, and that scholar says that answer, and it never tells us which of them is right. Do you know anybody who has a scroll of the Talmud? Oh, yes, my cousin has a scroll of part of the... Read it and come back to me. Oh, this Talmud. This scholar says this, and that scholar says that, and this commenter says what that scholar really means is this, and others say, no, it's what... Yeah, I'm so confused, what am I to do? Go back and read Moses ben Maimon. Oh, Rabbi, this Maimonides is so clear. To every question, he gives one answer. And it's true. So let me go through the... for some reason, this has just stopped going. There it goes. All right, the sources of law. First, the Torah, biblical source. That's supposed to be the ultimate authority. About 200 AD, the Mishnah, and the Mishnah is essentially a summary of the views of the rabbis over the previous few centuries, and for any of lots of issues, it says, this sage argues this is the answer, that sage argues that answer. There are some scholars who think that the way it's written is supposed to signal which sage the author agrees with, but we don't actually know that. And the Mishnah is a volume about this thick. It's one thick book, I suppose, 600 pages, 800 pages in a modern translation. So it's quite a sizable source. Then the Talmud. You have people in the academies in Babylon and Israel arguing over the Mishnah for a couple of hundred years, and those arguments end up written down as the Talmud. And then those three things become the basis. Let me give you an example of why I have the view I do of the Talmud. This is a real example. The Mishnah says, he who leaves a jug in the public domain and someone else comes along and stumbled on it and broke it, the one who broke it is exempt. All right, you're not liable if somebody else left the jug there and you stumbled over it. What does the Talmud tell us? The Talmud gives us a view of three different authorities. They said in the household of Rab, in the name of Rab, we deal with the case where the whole of the public domain was filled with barrels. You'll notice that Mishnah says nothing about the whole of them. But that's not all. Samuel said, we deal with the case in which the jugs were in a dark place. The Mishnah also does not say this. Yohanan says, we deal with the case in which the jug was at a corner. The Mishnah also does not say this. So all three of them reverse the conclusion of the Mishnah, each by claiming that the Mishnah's conclusion is in a special case not specified, and the general case goes the other way around. So that's the basis of the story I was just telling you. I have not read anything like all of the Talmud. I have many other things I'd rather do with my life, but that's enough of a sample to make me unhappy with it. So the work, then you have later scholars such as Maimonides and many others, which is are based on this. Basically, if you look through the scholarship, there are two approaches to how you write a book of law. One of them, which is the Mishnah's approach, multiplied in the Talmud, is you give arguments for multiple alternative interpretations. And the argument for that is that the judge who finally makes a decision has to look at all the arguments on both sides to decide what he thinks is right. And the alternative approach is let the author of the book decide for himself what he thinks is the best answer. Just give that. Why confuse the poor judge? Because after all, you're talking about an enormous volume of scholarship. You can't expect an ordinary judge to be competent in it. Let him just find an authority he can trust and go with him. And that's what Maimonides does. The Mishnah Torah is Maimonides. It's, about 15 fairly thin volumes in English translation. I've read about five or six of them that corresponded to chunks of modern law because that was what I was interested in. Lots of it is straight religious law. Eventually, Joseph Caro did both. What he did was to produce two volumes. The big volume is one which, for each issue, tries to give at least what he thinks are the important arguments on all sides, and then the shorter version in which he says, basically, I'm not wise enough to know what the right answer is, but other scholars might be. So he picks what he thinks are the three top scholars, of whom Maimonides is one of them, and any case where two of them agree, where at least two of them agree, he accepts that as the right answer. And where all three of them disagree, he then goes to some secondary scholars and, in effect, polls their opinions. I say poll. None of these people are alive anymore when he's writing, but they wrote down what they had to say and goes by that. And the only problem at that point was that he was doing law from Sephardic sources. As many of you probably know, you've got the major division in the exiled Jewish population is between the Sephardim, who were basically Spain and North Africa and the Middle East, and the Ashkenazi, my ancestors, who were Europe. And so Moses the Serless wrote a supplement which gave the view of the Ashkenazi authorities where it disagreed with the Sephardi authorities in that. That was the tablecloth to Caro's table, was the way it was labeled. And it, yes?
When was Joseph Caro?
Who, boy? 1600 somewhere. Okay. I'd have to look it up, but relatively modern by these terms. Maimonides is around 1,000 or so, okay. But I'd have to look them all up to be sure. Yeah.
Was Joseph Caro
So two questions. Obviously, you know, today, in most places, you know, Jews don't live under Jewish law. At least that's my understanding. When did things change to where they lived under?
Yes, that's a good question. And the answer is that there is a roughly the 18th to 19th century where the change is not with the Jews but with the authorities. That basically you have a shift to the French government and many other governments thinking of people as Frenchmen who happen to be Jews rather than as Jews who happen to live in France. And at that point, they are shifting to applying the ordinary laws to those people. And that's generally thought of as a positive change, and in some ways it probably was, but it was also a negative change and sort of the way obvious from this discussion.
Did the Jews pretty much accept that when it happened?
I think so, yeah. I'd have to know a lot more detail than I do. But even Israel isn't under Jewish law. That is, the Israeli law has certainly elements of Jewish law with regard, I think, to issues like marriage, but it's still a modern statutory legal system, which in lots of ways is not consistent. And occasionally there are problems because there's a sizable, politically influential, very Orthodox minority in Israel. So that one of the cases which I came across is that the... Now I'm trying... No. I don't remember the details enough, sorry. I got it in the book, but I don't want to try to mislead you. But it was basically a case where, in order to avoid letting the relevant Jewish law come into effect, they were not allowing DNA tests of paternity. Yeah, I think the problem was that under Jewish law, a momzer is not exactly a bastard. A momzer is a child whose parents not only weren't married, but couldn't have been married. So that an incestuous or an adulteress, because a woman can't marry two husbands, although a man under initial Jewish law, though no longer could marry two wives, or 20 wives in principle. So a momzer had certain restricted rights. In order to prevent that from going into effect, I think couldn't get married religiously, if I remember correctly. In order to prevent that, the courts refused to allow DNA testing in the case of a child whose mother believed it was the child not of her husband. But that meant that she couldn't get child support from the actual father of the child, and so that raised a problem in the conflict between the two. Well, how it turned out, I'm afraid I can't tell you, but I came across that as an interesting example. All right, let me go on. The next problem that starts arising has to do with the communal authorities, that you've got exiled Jews scattered across the world, mostly Europe, Middle East, North Africa, in little communities inside other places, the ghetto in Venice, for example. And how are they going to actually settle legal questions? How are they going to decide what the rules are, try people, and so forth? They very likely don't have a scholar competent to answer these questions, and they in any case have their own problems specific to that particular community, and they offered a variety of arguments for claiming the communal authorities could act, as it were, as a legislature and as a court. And the ultimate argument, I think, was that they couldn't survive if they couldn't, although that wasn't the way it was mostly put. And one of the lines of argument they made was to say that the communal authorities had a free hand with regard to relations between people. And the argument there was sort of analogous to people talking about social contracts today. The argument is that men can agree with each other on the terms of their contracts, and therefore you could think of the community as sort of a contract of all the people in it, and they can agree about matters that men can agree on. But they can't agree about their obligations to God. God decides those. So therefore, the communal authority was held to have a free hand in matters of mammon, but not in matters of Esor, not in matters of religious law. And that raised a problem with marriage law. And the problem was that under Torah, all that's required for marriage is the agreement of the parties, two witnesses, and a token, typically a wedding ring. And the age of adulthood under Jewish law is 12 and a half for women, provided some evidence of puberty, and 13 for men, provided some evidence for puberty. So that meant that a 13-year-old couple could marry each other without the permission of their parents. Parents were not happy with this. If you read in the book, I discuss an analogous case in sort of 19th century English and, I guess, American law, which raised the same issue of parents wanting to control who their kids married. So How do you deal with this? Well, one way of dealing with it is that communal law adds additional requirements. How do you justify them? Because marriage is obviously isur, it's part of religious law, so how does the communal authority do it? Very simple. The wedding ring is mammon. The wedding ring is a piece of property. But the communal authorities have authority over property. So if the communal requirements for the weddings are not satisfied, the ring retroactively forfeits. And since the groom didn't own the ring, therefore the wedding was not a valid wedding. So the marriage hasn't happened. All right. Not a very good system, and not the solution they ended up with. It's got its own elegance, but it had a practical problem. And the problem is that people were marrying across communities. So you have a woman who, according to her communal authorities, is marriageable because her young marriage didn't really happen, legally speaking. And she marries somebody in another community, and they are happily married, and they have two or three kids. And then someone discovers that she had been previously married. And since the community of her husband, the community she's now living in, does not accept this idea of retroactive forfeiture, that means that that was an illegitimate marriage. Not only are the parents not married, they couldn't have been married because you can't marry a married woman. Hence, their children are momsers. That's not a very attractive result. So I'm not sure if that's the reason, but that's at least part of my guess of the reason why they generally retreated from that line and took the alternative position, which has appeared in a number of other contexts, which is the marriage happened, but we will compel the husband to divorce the wife, because husband can divorce the wife unilaterally with certain legal consequences and under Jewish law, and therefore you can lock him up until he does. And you get versions of that solution in a number of different contexts, I think Islamic as well as Jewish, where only a husband can divorce. The court really thinks that you ought to have a divorce and therefore tries to compel the husband to grant it. Oaths play an interesting role in many systems. We have a sort of a fossil version of that in our system. You're supposed to swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and so forth and so on. I'm not sure how seriously people take it, because I at least would not greatly increase the degree to which I believed a witness after he had said the oath, but some people certainly it's going to be serious for. But oaths play a significant role in Jewish law, in Islamic law, I think in some other systems. Plains Indian law, too. An oath in the proper form in Jewish law shifts the balance of proof. So we start out with the simplest case where I accuse you of something I suspect you have done, but I don't know you've done. My cow is missing, and I think you stole it. In that case, all you have to do is say, I didn't do it, and the case is over. I don't have any evidence. Next case, where I know you stole it, but I can't prove it. I saw you steal it. So now it's what you could think of as a he said case. I said he stole it. He said he didn't. In that case, if the defendant is willing to swear in the proper form that he didn't do it, the case is over. He can swear and leave, basically. The next case is the one where I have some substantial amount of evidence. Now it reverses. Now, if I can prevail, but only if I'm willing to swear that I'm telling the truth. If I'm not willing to swear, I lose the case. And then if the evidence gets strong enough, I don't have to swear, I just win the case. So it's a sort of a tweaking the balance of who has what obligations. But the interesting thing, one of the interesting things, is the implication of their taking this seriously is that they believe people really were reluctant to swear falsely. And one obvious reason is you think God will punish you if you do. And there may be other reasons. Because a suspect party is not permitted to swear. A suspect party is somebody where there's reason why his oath can't be trusted. And there are two fairly obvious reasons why his oath can't be trusted. One of them is that he swore to something in the past that turned out to be false. Well, that might be a reason to be careful about swearing to things, especially things you're not certain are true. But another reason is that he has been observed to violate the rules of religious law. And he's therefore a suspect party. And if he doesn't really believe in the religion, why should you trust his oath, which depends on his believing enough to think he'll be punished by God if he's lying? And that's interesting because that suggests that religious rules have a sort of a side function. I'm thinking of things like the kosher rules, that the fact that you follow them even when it's inconvenient is evidence you believe in the religion. If we know that you believe in the religion, we can then trust you when you swear. So that gives you a sort of a lie detector. If for the court. And oaths play similar roles in Islamic, Romani, and yes.
I can see how it even would have an effect on people who didn't believe in the religion. In other words, you still have to follow the oath rules here, even if you don't believe in the religion, because if you become a suspect party, someone can then go after you legally,
yep.
And now they can apply oaths. They have the advantage of using yep. oaths against
that you. Was my first point. That's why I said that is one reason. That's one reason not to swear to something that might later be covered as false, is because it would make you a suspect party.
It's entirely evidence that you believe in the religion.
No, wait a minute. We've got two different things. The evidence you believe in religion is not your oath. The evidence you believe in the religion is that you go to a good deal of trouble to do all the things that the religious law says you're supposed to do.
All the things, not just the oath.
Yes, such as keeping kosher and a lot more complicated things than that. Legal consequences of wounding or killing. And here are my sources, Maimonides, who was my favorite. And there are five effects of wounding somebody. Damage, pain, medical treatment, idleness, and humiliation. And then you face the problem that we have in modern law as well. If I am injured, how much do you owe me for the injury? If I suffer pain through the pain, how much do you owe me for that? And Maimonides answers these questions. Gives a perfectly good economist answer to the question of how much the cost to me of losing my left hand or something. Because the right way, as an economist can tell you, to determine values is to look at markets. And Maimonides conveniently has a market available. All right, you ask, if I were a slave, how much would I have been worth on the slave market before I got injured? How much less am I worth on the slave market after I am injured? Well, that's a measure of the cost to me, the degree to which I'm less productive or whatever it is that matters as a result of the injury. Well, he's got to be a little more hypothetical in the case of pain, but it's, again, an economist's kind of answer. The answer is, if you were condemned by the king to have your hand cut out, how much would you pay to have it done under anesthesia? He doesn't use the term anesthesia. He says have it done with drugs, and he may be thinking of opium. I'm not quite sure what was available, certainly much less than is available to us. Well, that's the measure of what is the dollar equivalent to you, as it were, or the shekel equivalent to you, of the cost of having the pain. So I thought those were sort of neat, the way he's giving what are in a certain sense logical answers to these questions. Murder, direct murder is a capital offense. Now, I should say, I don't have this in the PowerPoints, but there are some odd things here, because in order to convict somebody, you're supposed to have two eyewitnesses. And in general, to convict somebody of a capital offense, you're supposed to have two eyewitnesses who not only saw him do it, but told him that it was a capital offense before he did it. And Maimonides goes into some detail on the difficulties of this and how, in principle, even if you see somebody coming out with a bloody knife and there's his body inside, you can't convict him on that basis. But you can do various other things to him. And there's a good deal of sort of tension between the formal legal requirements and the ways around it in what he has. And one of those cases is indirect murder. So suppose I didn't kill him, I hired an assassin to kill him. Well, the law does not allow me to be executed for that. On the other hand, if there were a king of Israel around, he could put him to death by royal decree. And a court could say that as an emergency measure, we're going to put him to death. And if you don't have either of those excuses, Maimonides says, you imprison him for a very long time and you nearly starve him to death and you generally, treat him horribly in order to make sure that nobody else will say, aha, if I kill somebody indirectly, I can get away with it. So he's thinking clearly in a deterrence kind of model. But one of my favorite Maimonides things is the following line of argument, that false testimony leading to execution is itself a capital offense. This means that you can generally believe such testimony, because after all, the witnesses don't want to get executed themselves if it turned out that it wasn't true. There is, however, a special case where you can't believe it. Killing somebody who is dying of a fatal disease is not murder. You've got to be sure he's dying of a fatal disease, but he'd die anyway. But the fact that it's not murder means that falsely testifying that somebody who is dying of a fatal disease committed murder is not itself murder. And since falsely testifying about somebody dying of a fatal disease is not murder, you cannot trust any witness who gives such testimony. And since you can't trust any witness to give such testimony, if you happen to be dying of a fatal disease and kill somebody, no witnesses against you can be believed. So as long as you're careful not to kill him in front of the court, you get away with it. There are lots of other examples. Maimonides has a lot of fun with sort of the playing with the logical structure of these rules. He's got, yes?
So this was about basically a mercy killing. But then it says if you are the person who's dying,
yes,
and you kill someone,
yes,
which is a different situation,
then you can get away. The argument is that if you follow the rules strictly, you can get away with it because the witnesses against you, the people who saw you do it, can't be trusted. Because if they were lying, they would not themselves be punished, because lying in court about someone who's going to die anyway is not a capital offense. I don't think it's an offense at all.
So save up all your
right. But there are other cases. He's got in his marriage stuff, he's got one case where you're afraid you might be married, but you don't know who you're married to. This is where you have appointed an agent to find you a wife. And the agent... Married is a little complicated. There's a betrothal marriage sequence, but the betrothal is binding in that system. And so this person is going out with your authority when he finds a suitable person to betroth you to it. And then the person disappears, dies or something. So you don't know whether or not he's betrothed you to anybody. Now, this doesn't keep you from marrying someone, because under at least early Jewish law, you can have more than one wife. But you can't marry two sisters. And you can't marry a sister and a woman and a daughter and her mother. And there are some other restrictions. So if you don't know who you might be betrothed to, you don't know who out there might be somebody you can't marry. And he has another case where he has five women who have all had one child, and then in a dark place, they all have another child, and they get mixed up about whose child is whose. And there are various rules in Jewish law where if a man dies without a son, his wife is supposed to marry his brother and then bear a child who will be treated legally as his child for him. But Maimonides says, now what happens when you don't know which one is your brother because you don't know which of the children? So it's a lot of fun. It really is. On the other hand, I have to admit that my younger son reads Maimonides to put him to sleep. Yes?
Curious that we didn't get to the evaluation of humiliation.
Yes.
Will we get to that later?
No.
Or does Maimonides not treat that?
Oh, I think he does discuss it, but there's a whole lot more on Jewish law than I could possibly cover in even 2 hours, and I don't have 2 hours because I'm going to do Islamic law and other stuff as well. So, no, the answer is I believe he does cover that. He covers a whole bunch of stuff, but the library here, I think, has got all of the Mishneh Torah. So if you people have permission or some way of getting in at it and are sufficiently curious, you can browse in Maimonides yourself. Yeah.
In the case of the betrothed who dies,
yeah,
both of the betrothed are don't know that they're...
We don't know that there has been a betrothed. Presumably she knows who she's betrothed to. She might, but she might not know where he is. That is, she might not bother to get in touch with him. We don't know. I mean, this is not a world with cell phones. What prospective wife? How do you find her? There are 100,000 people out there, any one of whom might be the one who he decided was the right one.
Oh, I see. You're already betrothed, so you can't do it.
You're afraid that what you can do is to make sure that if you marry somebody else, she doesn't have a living mother or sister.
Oh.
Or check out her mother and sister to make sure that they haven't gotten betrothed to you. Anyway, it's interesting stuff. Enough on Jewish law for the moment. If you're sufficiently curious, there's the whole chapter in my book, and if that isn't enough for you, you can go find the Mishneh Torah and read it for yourself or other sources. I list my sources there. But I thought I would go on to at least start on Islamic law before the end of this hour, though I don't think I'm going to finish it before the end of this hour. And I want to start out with the term Sharia, because I think it is badly misused in most contexts. Now, there's some question. Not everybody would agree on this. But at least as I interpret the system, Sharia is law in the mind of God. And in that sense, Sharia is enforced either nowhere or everywhere. That is to say, it can't be enforced by a court because courts can't read God's mind. They can make estimates of God's mind. On the other hand, in a sense, it's enforced everywhere because the enforcement is by God in the afterlife. So if you do something Now, what the rules are depend on whether you're a Muslim or not, I should say. That the Muslim position basically is that the other Abrahamic religions are also legitimate religions, even though they've got things a bit wrong, and therefore if you're a Christian, you don't have the same, you have a set of obligations, but not the same obligations as you would if you were a Muslim. If you're a Jew, you've basically got the obligations of Jewish law and so forth. But if you're a Muslim, and there are things you do that you shouldn't do, the result is you'll be punished in the afterlife. And if there are things you should do and you do them, you'll be rewarded. So that Islamic law has this set of five categories of actions, which range from actions where you'll be rewarded for doing them and punished for not doing them, through actions where you'll be rewarded for doing them but not punished for not doing them, to actions that are neutral, the ones that flip over, where you will be rewarded for not doing them and punished for doing them, and so forth. But then what a Islamic court actually can enforce is fiqh, jurisprudence. And fiqh is the imperfect human attempt at a law code derived from their understanding of Sharia. I think that's a fair description of the situation, though not all people, including not all Muslims, would agree with that reading of it. And to see the analogy about the relation between Sharia and fiqh, I like to think about the two senses in which you can talk about whether a law is constitutional. If you're a lawyer or a lower-level judge, what constitutional means is the Supreme Court has said it's constitutional. But if you're a Supreme Court justice, that's not the right answer, because you're trying to decide, what should I say? Maybe we should overrule the previous case. So from the standpoint of the Supreme Court justice, the question is, what does the Constitution say as interpreted by whatever I believe are the correct rules of interpretation? And that's a different question from the question of what does the Supreme Court say? And similarly, Sharia is, if you are a top-level legal authority, then you are trying to say, given the original religious sources, what should the law be? If you are a qadi, a judge somewhere out in the Islamic world, well, you are presumably following one of the four schools of law. You can look at what's been written by the scholars in that school and see what they say the answer is. And that's fiqh. But they're separate. There are things that are forbidden by God, but that the court system does not punish as well as things it does. That Sharia really combines what we think of as law and what we think of as morality. And then, presumably from the standpoint of lots of non-Muslim religious believers, you can get punished in heaven for doing immoral things. It doesn't follow that all of them should be illegal. Right? So it's not all that different. There are four schools of Sunni law. Each of them is the work of a chain of scholars. Each of them is named after someone who's thought of as sort of the founding and most wise, et cetera, scholar. And there are not entirely believable stories about how much each of those original scholars knew. And no modern scholar is nearly as good, we are told. But in general, the four schools agree on most general issues, but disagree a good deal on details of interpretation. The question of, given that everybody agrees you're not allowed to drink wine, it's not entirely clear what that covers beyond fermented grape juice. Is whiskey forbidden or not? It's going to depend on the school. Yes?
So you say Sunni law. So is there schools of law of Shia law?
Yes. That's, Shia is another system, and some modern Sunni scholars would like to argue that at least one of the Shia ones should really count as the fifth school. But I'm not really trying to cover the Shia. That a Shia is another interesting one. And the initial difference is that the Sunni view is basically that revelation ends with Muhammad, that he's the last prophet. And the Shia view is that he's the last prophet, but that then there are a series of people who, among other things, are descendants of his through his daughter, who are inspired sort of saintly religious leaders who are also inspired, and therefore you can use stuff from them as a source of legal authority as well. However, it's not still, well, it's still running for one of the Shia groups, but for most of the Shia groups, the view is that the last of those went into occultation. He's been in hiding for 1,000 years or so we don't have to worry about getting, but there's an exception to that, but I just don't, Islam is complicated enough, I don't think I can cover anything like all of the interesting stuff there. The four schools are mutually orthodox. That is, none of them regards the other as heretical. because given the limitations of the source, sources, reasonable men may differ. And a mushtahid, a religious scholar, who correctly deduces the law from the Quran and the traditions, gets two rewards in heaven, and if he gets it wrong, he gets one reward in heaven. So you still get a reward for trying, as it were. The sources of religious law for Muslims. The Quran has a good deal less clear law than the Torah does. And it's not... One of the ambiguities is when the Quran says something, how do you interpret it for the law? So, I don't know what that is. Not me, I'm pretty sure. Is the rule that they're giving you a rule or is it an example? Is there a general principle which this thing is illustrating or is it just limited to that? And the Quran is not internally consistent. The Quran is a series of revelations. The dating is somewhat ambiguous. The standard order, I think, in which it's printed is from the shortest verse to the longest verse, verses being like chapters. There are opinions about what was revealed when, but it's not like written on the page, so to speak. But the general view is that where there's a contradiction, the later verse takes over, and the assumption is that God was making less strict rules at the beginning because he knew that if the rules were too strict, nobody would follow Muhammad, and as people more and more were convinced to believe in it, he was willing to impose stricter rules. And each of the schools has its rules of how you interpret it. The other source are the hadith, and the hadith are the traditions. And they are basically little snippets saying, on the following occasion, the following person heard Muhammad say such and such, or saw Muhammad do such and such. And some of them are about the companions, his initial sort of like his disciples, so to speak, but largely about Muhammad. And the problem is that this is initially an oral tradition. It's not like there wasn't somebody standing next to the prophet writing down everything he said. So... each hadith is accompanied by its pedigree, by its isnad. And the isnad is in the form of Abu Huraira heard this, he told it to so-and-so, he told it to so-and-so, he told it to so-and-so, he wrote it down. And a serious scholar has to know a very large number of hadith. For each hadith, he has to know its isnad, and there may be multiple isnads. That is, a hadith is much more reliable if the same thing was narrated through different chains. From different people, and he has to know the reputation of the links in the chain to know whether you can actually trust this person to have gotten it right. So they're developed an enormous, elaborate scholarship over the centuries of trying to trace all of this down and trying to figure out which ones were true. Several people produced books which were basically all of the hadith we're pretty certain are reliable, and this is like, 8,000 hadith out of 100,000, or maybe several hundred thousand purported hadith. The general rule that I think all of them agreed was that to accept a hadith as certainly true, you needed multiple independent chains in support of it. Although how many you need and sort of the details of that are going to vary with the schools. And different scholars, naturally enough, differ about which hadith would be trusted. Because one of the problems with the whole system is that a hadith can be used as the basis for a legal ruling, and that means that there is an incentive to invent hadith in order to win law cases. And for other reasons, there's a story where one of the less wise caliphs is very fond of pigeon racing, and he or somebody asks one of the scholars at his court to recite me a tradition. And the man says, we have on the authority of Abu Huraira that he heard that the prophet said that there is to be no betting save upon an arrow or a hoof or a wing. And the caliph is very pleased at this because that means it's all right to bet on racing pigeons. And he says, give him a bonus, give him a bounty of 10,000 dirham. And as the man bows to accept the bounty, the caliph looks at him and he says, the nape of your neck looks like the nape of a liar's neck. I am certain that hadith was interpolated. And he has all his racing pigeons killed. But he was not a very wise man in lots of other ways. That's another issue. Yeah.
But these all are from the lifetime of Muhammad. Or are they?
That's an interesting question. I think certainly most of them claim to be. Some of them, I believe, are traditions about his companions, and so there might be one of those after his death. I don't really know. But the question of where they're really from is very much a disputed question. There's, in particular, one very prominent non-Muslim scholar argued quite a while ago that they were all fake, that essentially what happened was that the law developed in certain ways, people wanted support for it. Your opponent says, well, my support is that that's the way they did it in the Prophet's time. And so I say, oh, I've got even better support. Look, here is this tradition that Muhammad said that I was right. And other people dispute that. But I discussed it a little in the book, and there's a very prominent modern scholar who claims he disagrees with that. But if you really look at his disagreement, what he's really saying is maybe a few of them are real. But the... Yes? Yes. Well, this partly depends on how much you believe. The claim is that there were people who had memorized very large numbers of them. But also, once you had the couple of books of authenticated hadith, if you were not claimed to be at the cutting edge of the original scholars, but just a contemporary scholar, who of course are not as great as the founders of our school, then you've got the book in front of you, and the book has got the list of the 10,000 that Abu Muslim or somebody said he thought were real, and you can use those. But at least it's claimed that in the early period you have people who really had memorized like 100,000 or so.
Even if there are 10,000,
yes. But the interesting question is, could they? And then we certainly know that there have been people who have memorized long texts, people who memorize all of the Bible or all of the Quran. And whether it's true, I don't know. But it's clear that at least some of the claims made, sometimes made in the form of why we moderns can't possibly overrule the opinions of the ancient scholars, is that some of the ancient scholars had in their heads very, very large amounts of information.
So at what point in time was it down?
Huh. That's a good question, and I don't know. And it would probably be different for a different hadith.
But like 100 years after the Prophet, 1,000 years after the Prophet?
Not 1,000, but it might easily be 100. Yeah. My vague impression is that you usually have a few transmitters before it gets written down. There's a third basis third source for Islamic law, though, in addition to the Quran and hadith, and that's consensus. And that comes from a hadith. And it's a slightly wobbly hadith, though everybody accepts it, because it's one where the actual literal one is not supported through multiple chains. But there are several ones which seem to be implying the same thing, and so if you add them all up, you can claim that they are. And that's the statement that my people will never be agreed on an error. And that is held to imply that if it's any time in the past there is unanimous assent of the legal scholars to some statement, that statement must be true. Except that unanimous assent is a lot stronger than a court verdict. And exactly what unanimous assent means is not clear, and the schools disagree on it. Does assent mean that people say it's true, or just that nobody denied that it was true? Does it have to be for all schools or only within one school, and so forth? But the basic idea, at least, which they all agree on, is if you had enough agreement in the past, that finally settled a particular issue. Yes?
If you were litigating or arguing a case,
yes,
in school number one,
yes,
and things are going badly,
yeah, that's going to, I understand. That's going to be an issue that I was going to be discussing when I discussed the problems of polylegal systems, the general issue of what determines basically what judge hears what case. But in any case, it's now 2:00. So while I let you observe that rather interesting and provocative statement about Islamic law, it's a central doctrine of Islamic law, and probably about as true as the equivalent document in our doctrine in our law, which is not all that true, but I like to argue that there is no way you can have a public school system consistent with the separation of church and state. Uh, since the public school system, in order to do a halfway decent job, has to take positions on questions on some of which different religions differ, so therefore you're taking the side of one side or another. But anyway, that's a different issue. But at least in theory, law is separated from the state in Islamic law. I'm going to get a drink.
The way you have the scrolls,
mm-hmm.
and the scrolls are set up, I know I cannot
make
it in a large.
I'm sorry. That's not the way I'm seeing it here.
Last week you had it.
Yes, it should have been. I didn't realize that it wasn't. I'm sorry. This is supposed to be my view, not. How do I?
Yes. I don't know.
Let me figure out what's going on.
Tell you how bad
no,
my
you're
eyes
right.
are.
No, it's not supposed to be doing that. I didn't realize it was doing that. Anybody here who knows PowerPoint better than I do, who can explain why what it's showing up there is the presenter view rather than just the main page, which is what I'm seeing on this screen? No, none of you are PowerPoint experts. Yeah, I'm not a PowerPoint expert either, unfortunately. What?
The second go up high, all the way to the corner. Up.
That gives end show. Use slideshow. But now I'm not getting the presenter view. I can do that, but I prefer that the presenter view is supposed to show me what's going to happen next so that I know what to be ready for. And this I can do, and maybe it's the best I can do, but what it did last time, I think, was that I was seeing the presenter view and the screen was seeing. Yeah, and this screen was not. So how the devil do I tell it? Damn. I'm sure there is an answer, but I do not know what it is.
Are people really that... Go ahead, try that.
That's what I had before. And that, you see...
Now you got it.
I've got it. But I want that screen to be echoing this screen, which is what it was doing last time, and it isn't doing this time, and I don't know why.
I think...
And you would think that it would be something like View, but View has presenter view and slideshow view, neither of which is what I... One. Is there something
you go
if you can, sure.
Go to window.
Cell phone, so I'll go get him.
Sure, if you can, because they may be able to tell me, because I don't know why it was not doing it last time. And
go to window. The issue is that PowerPoint has got...
Arrange all, maybe?
No.
No?
No. It's not there. I don't know enough to say. Well, the problem is that you need these
reversed
essentially. Correct. You need to say...
Correct. And maybe something on this will do it, but I haven't figured out what.
It's not there. It's in the computer, external system.
protect your point. You can ask your question.
It's a very simple question. Just a minute.
Thank you so much.
Yes. I have it set at presenter view. And presenter view, this screen shows my actual slide, and this screen shows my slide plus what's coming next. Which is, unfortunately, that is showing the presenter view instead of that. That's supposed to show this screen. What did you do?
Click on that swap display.
Swap displays. Yeah. Very good. Thank you. Problem solved. All right, I think we've now got it set up so that you're seeing what you're supposed to see, which is the whole-size version rather than the presenter version. And I think it's been about 10 minutes, so we can keep going. Yes?
Yeah, so earlier, you listed some dates when control shifted between Jews and other groups. What happened in 70? Wasn't there a major Roman action in Israel in 70 AD?
Yeah, but I think that did not essentially destroy Israel as a society. Israel had been under first indirect and then direct Roman rule. And it's only at the point of the final revolt where the temple gets destroyed, I think, twice, if I remember correctly. And I don't remember the dates for that. And that matters because the temple plays a role in a bunch of things, so that the view of at least some modern Orthodox would be that there are parts of the law that you can't apply because the temple isn't there to apply it. And I should say, one of the odd and interesting things about Maimonides is that he gives the rule, the law, including, in effect, without comment, rules that are no longer possible. That if you kill somebody you are and it's not considered a capital offense. You are exiled to one of the cities of exile, none of which any of which exist when Maimonides is writing. That doesn't bother him. And he talks about what the rights are of the king of Israel, despite the fact there is no king of Israel. So it's not clear whether he's a completist, whether what he's trying to do is to give the entire law, including the chunks that are at the moment, or whether he really believes that eventually the kingdom of Israel will be restored, and therefore he wants to get the law as it will apply at that date. But in any case, as I was saying, one of the interesting things about Islamic law is the doctrine of the separation of law and state, the idea that the ruler does not make the law. That the ruler appoints the judges, the qadis, but at least in theory, he doesn't make the law. The law is deduced from religious sources, the sources I was describing in the previous slide. So suppose you have a legal question, which might be what we would think of as either a moral or a legal question. You go to a mufti, and a mufti is somebody regarded as an expert in the law. It's not an official position. It is not paid, at least pre-Ottoman. It isn't. And he writes you a fatwa. And what a fatwa is an advisory legal opinion. And if the issue is a moral question, he tells you how you ought to act according to Sharia, his interpretation of Sharia. And if it's legal, you can now go to the qadi when you actually try your case and offer him the fatwa as evidence of what the law is. The mufti is not looking at the facts at all. That's not what he's giving an opinion on. He's only saying, given the following asserted facts, here are the legal implications. And it's then up to the qadi, to the judge, to investigate the facts and render a judgment. He's not legally required to accept the mufti's ruling. It's possible that the qadi is himself a legal expert, but he doesn't actually have to be, because he can rely if he chooses. He could himself send out for a mufti's opinion, and so forth. In a way, it's like our system turned upside down, in that in our legal system, the court of the first impression is the one that investigates the facts. And then if there's an appeal, the appeals court takes the facts as established by the court of first impression and says, given those facts, did they get the legal implications wrong? So it's not exactly symmetrical, but it's sort of like our system, except the order is reversed. Practice with both Islamic and Jewish law, a point I will discuss a little more in a little bit, did not always fit the theory. But the theory, at least, was that the law was independent of the ruler. And at least one of the prominent modern scholars has argued that to a considerable extent for quite a long time it was true. That what was going on was that you had Middle Eastern principalities and such, ruled largely by Turkish princes who had started out as mercenaries and ended up working their way up, as it were, that what they wanted from the legal system was support for their legitimacy so the people they ruled would approve of them, and they didn't really much care what the details of the law were, so they were willing to say, unless it really gets in our way, you can decide what the law is. We'll support you as long as you support us. And that eventually breaks down, but that's his view of it. The Ottoman Empire, which is one of the places where it eventually did break down, there is a parallel law code called the Kanun. And in theory, all of these parallel law codes are just sort of filling in the blanks in Islam, in the Quranic law and enforcing it and so forth. But in fact, in some places, the Kanun is inconsistent with fiqh, because Islamic law is pretty generally interpreted forbids loans at interest, and the Kanun sets a maximum interest rate. What happened to this system? The system broke down, and at least as I read it, it really broke down under the rise of the state. And some of the scholars claim it was the fault of the Western colonialists that in places like India, they didn't really understand the system, so they tried to study what Muslim law is and then says, all right, we'll put it into our legislation, rather than having a system where you had courts where the law itself was independent of the ruler. However, the Ottoman Empire is my counterexample, because the Ottoman Empire was never a colony. And it's quite clear, I think, if you watch what happened, that the state was gradually taking over the legal apparatus. So that in the Ottoman Empire, one of the four schools of law was favored. In the core parts of the empire, that was the only school. And in the more peripheral parts of the empire, the other schools existed, but were subject to sort of a dominance by the preferred school. In the traditional system, there were what we would think of as foundations, waqfs, where somebody sets up a legal structure and gives it a bunch of money to maintain a mosque, to fund scholars, to maintain a public fountain, to take care of his descendants. There were lots of different ways blocks could be used. They were essentially legally independent things that somebody had donated a bunch of money to. And they exist. A waqf could keep existing for hundreds of years. The Ottomans eventually took over the waqfs. Their explanation was, we will continue to do the things they're supposed to be doing. It's just that we'll administer the money now. But you can guess how that really turns out in practice. In the Ottoman system, there was an official head mufti appointed by the Sultan who was supposed to give advice on the religious part of the system. So I think if you really look at it, that the pattern exists both in the colonized and the non-colonized parts. And I would argue that it's parallel to what was happening in Europe, because if you think about it, Henry VIII's seizure of the monasteries looks a lot like the Ottomans' seizure of the waqfs. And Henry VIII replacing the Pope with himself looks a good deal like the Sultan, who eventually claims to be Caliph by the later Ottoman Empire, and who in any case claims to control the religious system to appoint everybody, in effect, in it. So, anyway, if you look at modern Islamic states, they talk about having Sharia, but almost all of them, what you're really doing is a modern system of legislated law, where they're including in the legislation bits and pieces lifted from the traditional law. Saudi Arabia is a partial exception. Saudi Arabia, as far as I can tell, is sort of a combination of the traditional system plus some state law on top of it. Let me say a bit about the contents of the law. There are really three major categories to Islamic law proper. The first is Had, and those are the five Quranic offenses where they have a specified punishment, and not optional, sort of like the Sentencing Commission, only a little more extreme. And they are thought of as being from the Quran. I think maybe three or four of them are literally in the Quran, and I think one of them is actually from the practice of one of the first couple of caliphs who were held to be inspired by the example of Muhammad. But the five ones, the first one is zina, and zina is sexual intercourse with somebody who is neither your spouse nor your legal concubine. There are very high requirements of proof. There must be four eyewitnesses to the same act of intercourse, all of whom must be adult male Muslims of good reputation. On the other hand, the penalty, if the guilty party has had legal intercourse, is stoning to death. And if he has not had legal intercourse, it's 100 lashes. 50 for a slave, I should say. That's a common pattern. The slaves get half the punishment. Kafr is false accusation of zina, which makes, of course, zina even harder, because if it turns out that you can't prove it, you're in trouble. There were, however, special rules where a husband believed that the wife's child was not his. So he could accuse her of having had adultery, and even if he couldn't prove it, if he's willing to swear the right kind of oath, he's let off from the punishment for false accusation, and if she's willing to swear the right kind of oath, she doesn't get held guilty of zina, assuming they don't really have their four eyewitnesses to prove it. Shurb is wine drinking, and both the definition and the punishment vary. The punishment is some number of lashes, but I think it's either 40 or 80, if I remember correctly, depending on which school it is. And the interpretations of it range from only wine, literally, that is fermented grape juice, plus getting thoroughly drunk on something else, where one passage I saw says, so drunk you cannot tell the earth from the sky or a man from a woman. And I'm told that this was the interpretation the Turks preferred. But whereas at the other extreme, you have the view that anything that can get you drunk in any quantity, however large, is illegal in any quantity, however small, which I think of as their version of the Delaney Amendment, which is the one that says that anything counts as a cancer causer if in sufficiently large quantities it causes cancer. The sarika, this is the one that's famous because it's cutting off people's hands. Theft, however, I'll talk about this a little bit more later, but there are a bunch of restrictions on what it takes in order for theft to count for this purpose. Qat al-Tariq is highway robbery, which includes armed robbery of a home. and the punishment is at least cutting off one hand and one foot, and in more serious cases, execution. Then the next category is tazir, and those are offenses where the punishment is not fixed, where the punishment is set at the judge's discretion. Most scholars hold that the maximum punishment has to be less than the corresponding had punishment. On the other hand, the standards of proof are also lower than for had. I think for the had offenses other than zina, I think it's two eyewitnesses. And I'm not sure whether there are some contexts where multiple women can substitute for one man as witnesses. And there are some less severe cases where one woman and one man classify as two. That varies according to the details. And then the third category, and the yes?
Can you give another example of tazir? For instance, maybe arson?
Maybe what?
Arson.
I suppose if it isn't a hot offense and is considered illegal, the exceptions are going to be the jinniyat ones, which are part of the Quranic law, but where they're treated in effect as torts, not as crimes, from our point of view. And I don't know where arson would fit in that. But that jinniyat is killing or bodily harm, and that is something where the prosecution is by the victim or his kin, in that sense, is like a tort case. And that's one where, if it's roughly speaking what we would think of as first-degree murder, then the survivors have the option of asking for retaliation, of asking Aaron to have the person himself killed. But they also have the option of accepting money payment. And there is a fixed money payment, a diya, defined in camels, as a certain number of camels of various age and sex. Traditionally, there was a rule for converting that into other forms. And in modern Saudi Arabia, it's a payment of something over $100,000. I should say, the last year I taught this course, as I may or may not have mentioned, most of my class was Saudi LLM students. So the result was that I actually had primary sources in my classroom. And that was, I'll get into a little bit more of that later, but that was really quite interesting. But in any case, it's for them to prosecute. They could accept a lower money payment if they figure the person can't pay the appropriate amount. The money damages, there are rules for scaling it for things less than killing somebody. And the basic rule, which is not entirely fair, but it sort of gives you an answer, is if you cut off one hand, I have two hands, so the damage payment owed is half the damage payment that would be owed if you killed me. I think my nose is going to be a full damage payment, a finger a tenth, and so forth. But there are other categories where I think they use the same rule Maimonides does, that you look at the slave market and see how much that injury would reduce the slave's value. Pretty sure I saw that. Yeah? I understand. The answer is I just don't know. I've got a big, thick book of Islamic law from one of the schools, and I can look and see whether it mentions it, but it may or may not. It's pretty well indexed. But oh, I see. You're right. In principle, if we knew, yeah, you could imagine a case where the person himself wants to die, and his family says to somebody, "If you kill him, we won't prosecute, or if you kill him, we'll settle for a penny." And I don't see any reason why that couldn't happen. I don't know if it did or not. It seems sort of logically to make sense. Now, in addition, killing somebody was an offense against, or at least killing a Muslim, maybe killing anybody, I'm not sure, was an offense against God. And therefore, you also had a further punishment that you had to either free a believing slave, a Muslim slave, or fast for 2 months. And the Muslim fast means no eating, drinking, or sex in daylight. That's the Ramadan fast, but it's also a fast as a sort of a penalty for various things. Next topic is one which is interesting to me partly because of what I learned from my students. And that's something called the Aqila. And the Aqila was apparently a kinship group who shared in the payment of damages. And we'll come into something similar to that later in Somali law. where you have a group of people where if I am found to have killed somebody, which could be murder or it could be what we would think of as tortious loss of life or something, I owe a certain amount of damages, and there are a group of people connected to me who are supposed to pay part of that damage payment. And it, what? And what?
Why are they supposed to pay part of it?
Well, presumably part of the reason is that that gives them an incentive to make sure that members of the group don't go around killing people. In the Somali case, it's mentioned that in some cases the group may forbid one of its members to carry a rifle because they paid too much money for his killings, presumably. And it presumably originates with the Bedouin tribes, which is what are really feeding into the early part of Islam. And according to my modern secondary source, the institution, quote, fell into disuse at an early date. According to my Saudi students, however, all of them knew what their Aqila was because it was their last name. It was indeed still the case that if one of them ran somebody down with his car and owed a large damage payment, that a part of that damage payment would be paid with a rule about how much each person had to pay by the other members of the Aqila. I think, though I am not certain, that it's the group they married within, because there was one woman among the students, and I had some very interesting conversations with her, and by her account, if her brother needed a wife, it would be up for her and her mother to find him a wife, because there was no way in Saudi society in which single men could socialize with single women, and therefore he wouldn't have met any of them, but single women could socialize with single women. And it was fairly clear from her discussion that if they were looking for a wife from him, it would be for a very, very restricted group of people who were basically their not very close kin. And I think that if I got it right, those would be the members of their Aqila. And typically, according to one of the sources I found, an Aqila would be a few thousand males and their families associated with it. Marriage. It's a contract. Husband and wife are legally independent actors. They have different rights. The wife's dowry is her property, as is other property she brings into the marriage. Commonly, part of the dowry is paid at marriage and part on divorce or the husband's death, which may make it expensive to divorce your wife, because at that point you'll have to pay it out. Wives cannot divorce their husbands. They can bargain for divorce. They can agree, if you'll divorce me, I'll agree not to take the money that you would otherwise owe me. And she might, in some contexts, get a court to compel her husband to divorce her. And she might, when she got married, include in the contract restrictions, such a restriction that he could only take a second wife with her permission. And otherwise, he'd have to divorce her if he took a second one. This gets me into another one of my medieval Islamic law and econ stories, of which I've got several. A certain vizier was going about the countryside taking petitions and giving alms and doing what had to be done. And a poor woman came to him with a petition for alms. And he wrote, "Pay this woman 100 dinar, and gave her the writing to take to his treasurer. And the treasurer was astonished that his master would give so large a sum in alms to a poor woman. And so he brought the writing back to the vizier, and he said, "Master, is this your hand?" And the vizier said, "It was in my intention to write, 'Pay this woman 100 dirham. But since it was the will of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, that my hand slipped, and I wrote dinar for dirham, gold instead of silver, pay it out as it is written." And so it was commanded, so it was done. 3 days later, the vizier received a petition from a poor old man. And the poor man said, "3 days before, you gave my wife 100 dinar, and she has now decided that she is too wealthy a woman to be married to a poor old man like me, and she is threatening to force me to divorce her. And my petition, therefore, is that you appoint someone in power to prevent my wife from making me divorce her." And the vizier thought a moment, took out paper and pen, and wrote, "Pay this man 100 dinar. And what's neat about that story is that the implication of the story is that while it's true that the wife couldn't divorce the husband, she could make being married to her so unpleasant that he would divorce her. And not only can she do it, but the vizier doesn't believe there's any very practical way of stopping her from doing it, no way that's less costly to him than simply giving an equal sum to the husband so she won't want to divorce him, which I think is sort of neat. And is relevant to the whole sort of law and econ question of contracts which are limited by enforceability. That if you think about the whole issue in a modern society of marriage as a contract, a lot of what constrains that is that many of the terms are not ones that are observable by the court and therefore are not ones that it's practical to enforce. As I think I say in one of my books, I don't think anybody has ever successfully sued for divorce on the grounds that his wife either cooked or made love badly. The terms of the marriage, the wife owes the husband obedience and sexual access. She has to sleep with him unless there's some actual good reason, such as her period, or she's sick, but she can't. The husband owes the wife adequate intercourse, which the sources I saw seem to mean enough so she wouldn't want to sleep with anybody else, but may also have meant enough so she could get pregnant and have children, which it's presumed is what wives want to do. And he has to support her at a level suited to her station, not his station. So if you marry a well-off wife, you've got to keep her, as it were, in relative luxury, which may or may not be easy to do. Of course, if you marry a poor wife, it's going to be very cheap. Taxation. There are two Quranic taxes, two taxes actually authorized by the religion. One of them is jizya, and jizya is a head tax paid by non-Muslims living under Muslim rule. Head tax meaning fixed amount per person. And the other, which is only paid by Muslims, is zakat. And that's a tax based in a somewhat complicated way on wealth, on the amount of gold you have, and on agricultural output, with one percentage for irrigated and a higher percentage for non-irrigated land. And what's interesting about that, from my standpoint, is that it is not a tax that has to be paid to the government. It is an obligation under religion. You may, if you wish, pay it to the government to distribute it. The jizya is supposed to go to a specific set of recipients. It's supposed to go to students, to the poor, to travelers, to warriors in religious war, and I forget the rest. It's 8 or 10 categories. I don't think maintaining the government is even in the list of categories, if I remember correctly. And it can be paid to the ruler to distribute accordingly. The taxpayer can distribute it himself. He can find people. Now, depending on which school of law it is, you may have to evenly distribute it among the categories, or you may be allowed to distribute it any way you like among the categories. Evenly would be harder. But there are also middlemen who take one cut of it in exchange for their distributing your money. So it's sort of an odd kind of tax that doesn't have to flow through the government, although it can.
So who imposes it?
God, ultimately. That is to say, you are a bad Muslim if you don't pay it. I presume that it's sometimes in places other people are watching and they force you to do it, but not necessarily. Yeah?
Before the afterlife, who enforces it?
Well, as I say, my guess is that's going to depend on time and place, that you might be in a situation where other people are watching you and will in some way punish you if you don't, and you might not. But it's ultimately a moral obligation, is all of these things. There are other taxes, but they're somewhat religiously dubious. There's a early North African political scientist who's got this wonderful sort of cyclical theory of history, and when things are going downhill and the regime's becoming corrupt, part of the evidence is they're imposing non-Quranic taxes. And he had got the idea long before modern people that when the taxes get too high, the revenue goes down because people stop making money and paying taxes on it. So much on Islamic law. Before I go on, are there questions on Islamic law before I go on to my when God is the legislator? And no. Yes. Yes. They're pretty late, and the answer is I don't know much about them. I think they're like an 18th century or 19th century. Yeah. Yeah, that's what Saudi now is. But I don't really know that. As I know, they're regarded as relatively fundamentalist, and I think the Saudis. I think the Saudis take Islam somewhat more seriously than many of the other groups, although not all of them. But I don't know anything really about the Wahhabi in particular. Yeah.
So when there's these issues that come up, I don't know how to describe it, communities that say, oh, they're going to impose Sharia law. Is this a local Muslim community that wants to impose Sharia law on its own?
What most of that is about is something which has existed for a long time and not just for Sharia. And that is that there are various circumstances in which modern legal systems are willing to accept, in effect, treat as arbitration other systems. If I sign a contract under French law, it can get enforced in a U.S. court under French law. That's the U.S. court trying to figure out what French law implies. Similarly, if I have a Jewish marriage from Israel, say, or a Muslim marriage, in principle, an American court is going to look at that. There will be some restrictions. They won't enforce rules they see as unconscionable. But as a general rule, it is possible in modern legal systems to get the rules of other legal systems enforced, provided it's the assent of both parties. You can sign a contract under those rules.
But it only applies to the people who were participating in the system in the beginning.
Yeah, that's right. That is, but of course, they might not still be participating. You could have a case where you had agreed to something where you got married under Muslim law, and then one of you stopped being a Muslim, and then there's a dispute on what the implications are, and the question of what you had agreed to becomes relevant. It's not decisive. The American court won't allow a polygamous marriage, for example. But as long as it's not too far outside of the bounds of what are allowed, for lots of different systems, you enforce foreign law to the extent of the parties.
But it can't be imposed on non-Muslims.
I suppose if a non-Muslim agreed to a Muslim marriage, you could then argue.
In general, you couldn't just go somewhere and open a mosque.
Not here. Not here. But on the other hand, if you are in a Muslim-ruled community, if you're in a Muslim-ruled country.
Right. Well, I understand that.
I mean, part of what the Muslims did for a very long time was to expand the area of Muslim-ruled countries.
Right.
And then at later points it got contracted. But in those contexts, the rules that apply to non-Muslims in Muslim-ruled countries are not the same as the rules that apply to Muslims, but they are rules defined by Muslim law, sometimes also by Christian law or Jewish law. Yeah.
In a Muslim country, are no laws secular?
I think that's going to have to depend on the country.
Okay.
I think that's probably true in Saudi Arabia, though even then, in fact, as I understand it, if you kill somebody deliberately in Saudi Arabia, even if you're willing to pay dia and the kin are willing to accept it, they still put you in jail for 10 years. So I think even in Saudi Arabia, you've really got a mix of the, yeah.
I think that the American political resistance to Sharia law really focuses on family law, because I know that there are ways that Muslims have worked around the no interest rule so that they can do business nationally. And I don't think there's any possibility of the criminal punishments being adopted in any American jurisdiction.
It's not even clear whether there is any criminal punishment in Muslim law for taking interest. That's one of the things.
I was another thing for killing someone, for doing something.
Yes.
I don't think.
Yes.
I don't think those are. So I think the focus of the politics is about Sharia law, and with that some implication of women's rights, but that would be some part of it. I think that's what all this hoo-ha about we don't want Muslim law in our country is really about family.
Yeah, but I think most of it is really also people imagining that it means that those laws apply to everybody and not just to the people who agree to it. Anyway, let me go on to when God is the legislator, which gets back to both of these systems and our system. And I would claim that Jewish law, Islamic law, and U.S. constitutional law raise similar problems, because you've got a sort of a fixed legal system, which in the first two cases you can't change theoretically. In the third case you can, but it's very difficult to change. And then the problem that arises is what happens when God gets it wrong. And let me run through some examples of this. From the Torah, if a man have a stubborn and rebellious son, which will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, and that when they have chastened him will not hearken unto them, then shall his father and his mother lay hold on him, and bring him out unto the elders of his city, and unto the gate of his place. And they shall say unto the elders of the city, this our son is stubborn and rebellious, he will not obey our voice, he is a glutton and a drunkard, and all the men of his city shall stone him with stones that he die. All right, that's the rule on the rebellious son. and the rule for the thief in Islamic law, whether man or woman cut his hand, which means cut it off, as punishment from God for what he had done. And the rule in American constitutional law is a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So I want to take these three examples. What do you do about those if you don't like those rules? Which, in all three cases, if you take the rule in its literal form, very few people are willing to argue that you should be allowed to have an atomic bomb in your basement, even though that is clearly a case of the right to keep arms, right? So how do you amend God's law? And one of them is what Jewish law calls midrash, interpretation. And there the rabbis have an advantage over even the constitutional scholars because they've got the doctrine of the oral Torah. And the doctrine is that in addition to God giving Moses the written Torah, which was written down and we have, he also gave an oral Torah, which Moses has passed down in oral tradition to the scholars, to the rabbis of the present day, and therefore they can use the oral Torah in order to interpret the written Torah, even in ways that may not seem very natural if you actually read the written Torah. Another way is rabbinic legislation, which sometimes permitted acts that were forbidden by the Torah and sometimes forbidden acts permitted. And one justification was to construct a fence around the Torah to make sure that they not only couldn't do things forbidden, couldn't do things even close to forbidden. And my standard example for that is one of the central law elements of kosher rules, which is you are not to eat milk and meat at the same meal. What Torah actually says is you are not to eat a kid stewed in its mother's milk. That is the entire basis for saying that you can't eat meat and milk at the same meal. My father used to tease my mother's mother, who was serious about these things, by asking whether they needed a different tablecloth for the table if they were going to eat meat on it sometime and milk on it sometime. Another rule is from necessity. The argument is, if we enforce this rule of Torah, we're going to get destroyed. Better to lose one letter than the whole Torah. And another is the claim that the legislation we're making is only temporary, so even though the Torah explicitly says you are not to add or subtract anything from its rules, that doesn't apply to temporary legislation. My father used to say that there is nothing so permanent as a temporary government program. And I believe the building in which I had lunch as in elementary school had been constructed as temporary construction for World War I. And then the third approach, another approach is ingenious uses of the law. So the Torah says that every 7 years all debts are canceled. And this raises certain practical problems if you want to persuade somebody to lend you money in the sixth year. And the author of Torah recognized his problems and he said, don't be stingy and refuse to lend people money in the sixth year. However, practical people saw that it wasn't going to happen. And so apparently Hillel constructed a contractual form in which you sort of took the debt out of your property and into your property for long enough to get it past that seventh year. And there are various rules I'll be discussing a little more later by which in all three Christian, Jewish, and Muslim systems, in all of which loans and interest were illegal, were forbidden. In all of them, they found ways of getting around it. And in fact, one source I read pointed out that one of the devices used in Christian law was actually borrowed from Muslim law along with its Arabic name. Let's go back to this disobedient son who was supposed to stone to death. Here is what Maimonides says about the requirements you have to meet before you get to stone him to death. He is not liable for stoning until he steals from his father and buys meat and wine at a cheap price. He must then eat it outside his father's domain, together with a group that are all empty and base. He must eat meat that is raw, but not entirely raw, cooked, but not entirely cooked, as is the practice of thieves. He must drink the wine as it is thinned as the alcoholics drink. He must eat a quantity of meat weighing 50 dinarim in one sitting and drink half a log of this wine at one time. According to the oral tradition, we learned that this law concerns a youth of 13. Between the time he grew 2 pubic hairs and the time in which his entire male organ is surrounded by pubic hair. After the entire male organ is surrounded by pubic hair, he is considered as independent and is not executed by stoning. If his father desires to convict him and his mother does not desire, or his mother desire and his father does not desire, he is not judged as a wayward and rebellious son, as defined by Deuteronomy 21:19. His father and mother shall take hold of him. If one of the parents has had his arm amputated, was lame, dumb, blind, or deaf, the son is not judged as a wayward and rebellious son. These concepts are derived as follows. His father and mother shall take hold of him. This excludes parents with amputated arms. And bring him out. This excludes the lame. They say. This excludes the dumb. This son of ours. That excludes the blind. He does not heed our voice. This excludes the dumb. So add them all up, and Maimonides concludes that it's never happened. And it's never going to happen. And he then has an explanation of why God has made a rule that he's never going to enforce, and it's for our education, essentially. Yeah?
He does not heed our voice. Doesn't that exclude the deaf?
I may have either miswrote that, or perhaps Maimonides or the translator got that wrong. Let's take the less extreme case of restricting the cutting off of people's hands. To qualify as the hot offense of theft, it must be above a minimum amount. And I think I calculated that the minimum amount was roughly equivalent to the amount that in 18th century English law made theft a capital offense, which was sort of interesting. We'll talk about that later. He's got to steal it from a protected place. So if you steal cattle that are grazing in a field, that does not count. Rustlers don't get their hands cut off. The person who steals it must be somebody who does not have access to the place. So if you're a guest and you steal from your host, well, that's an evil thing to do. You don't get your hand cut off. And it has to be stolen by somebody who has no reason at all to think he has a claim to it. So some scholars hold that theft from the treasury can't qualify because each Muslim believes that he has a partial claim to the wealth of the Muslims. Theft can still be a crime if it doesn't meet these conditions, but then it's a tazir crime, which means that the punishment is set by the judge rather than being kind of having your hand cut off. And consider similarly that to prove the hot offense of zina, it requires 4 eyewitnesses to the same act of intercourse, all of them adult male Muslims of good repute, and if one of them isn't, the rest are guilty of false accusation. And U.S. courts interpret the Second Amendment to permit lots of regulations on who can have what firearms, and an atomic bomb in your basement doesn't fall under the Second Amendment, as courts are likely to interpret. Let me give another U.S. example, which is one that I think is particularly striking. According to the 10th Amendment, the power is not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. All right, so that's fairly clear language saying that federal government can only do those things in the list of things Congress says that the Constitution says it can do, that it's a system of enumerated powers. Right. Federal government can only do things the Constitution authorizes. Article 1, Section 8 says the Congress shall have power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states. New Deal farm policy restricted what a farmer could produce so as to push up farm prices. The Supreme Court, threatened by FDR with packing, ruled that a farmer growing crops to be fed to his own animals was substantially engaged in interstate commerce and so could be regulated under Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. This is also the reason that growing marijuana for your own use in your own backyard in California is a federal crime, because that's regulation of interstate commerce. Right? So I think that's at least as outrageous as any of the Islamic and Jewish examples of interpreting things in the ways that give the result you want when you can't actually change the law what we'd like to. Another approach to the problem is to create a parallel set of rules to which the restrictions do not apply. So communal authorities, it was held by some people, could do things forbidden by the Torah under authority inherited from the kings of Israel. Because when Israel was really a kingdom, back before the Romans took it over, you had, in effect, both religious law and royal law, and the royal law was not restricted by the things that restricted religious law. There is, in fact, a passage in the Bible in which the people of Israel say they want a king, and one of the prophets says, here are all the terrible things that the king will do if you have a king. And some of the scholars interpret that as meaning if you do have a king, he's entitled to do all those horrible things. Other people interpret it as I would be inclined to, as this is a good reason not to have a king. Islamic rulers can and do establish marketplace regulations under the mutasib, police courts, administrative regulations, and this gets to another story. The poet Ibn Harma performed before the caliph, And so delighted was the prince of the Muslims with his performance that he said, name your reward. And Ibn Harma said, the only reward I wish from the prince of the Muslims is that he send word to his officials in the city of Medina that when I am found dead drunk upon the pavement and brought in for punishment, I be let off from the punishment prescribed for that offense. And the caliph said, that is God's law, not mine. I cannot change it. Name another reward. There is nothing else I desire from the prince of the Muslims. And so the caliph sent instructions to his officials in the city of Medina that if anybody found Ibn Harma dead drunk upon the pavement and brought him in for punishment, Ibn Harma should receive 40 strokes of the lash as the law commands. But whoever brought him in should receive 80. And ever after, when anyone saw the poet drunk upon the pavement, he would turn to his companion and say, 80 for 40 is a bad bargain, and pass on. Now, you may think that only crazy caliphs do this, but of course, this is also within the power of presidents. You will note that Obama had no legal authority to change immigration law without Congress, which wasn't willing to do it. So all he did was to instruct his officials that illegal immigrants who happened to have come as children were not to be deported. All right, that's precisely the same thing. It is using the fact that he has control over the enforcement to nullify a law that he cannot change as an actual law. Slightly less dramatic way of doing it, but it's the same principle. And one could go on. That is, I don't want to be unkind to Obama. You could think of lots of examples of Trump. You will notice from a bit I quoted a little bit that regulating trade with foreign nations is entirely the business of Congress. And yet, as you can read in the newspaper every day, the president believes he's got the power to set tariffs. And in the U.S., only Congress can make laws, but executive agencies can make regulations. Third way, around the rule, find ways around the rules, and there one example is the Christian, Jewish, and Muslim law forbade loans and interest. One solution is you set up a partnership contract. One partner provides capital, one provides labor, and they share the profit. So that's in effect an interest rate. Another is that you make the loan in one currency, agree to repayment in a different currency. Since you can't be certain what the exchange rates between the currencies will be, you aren't agreeing for certain to get 5% interest, just on average to get 5% interest. In modern Saudi Arabia, as I was told by one of my students, the bank gives you an interest-free loan, but only when you also agree to buy a car from the bank and then sell it back at a lower price. Jewish law forbids carrying anything on the Sabbath outside your own courtyard. What defines a courtyard? Well, you string wires around the neighborhood, and that makes the whole neighborhood a single courtyard. There are some very large courtyards in the Orthodox regions of New York City, I'm told. I wouldn't be a bit surprised, though I don't know. It's all an Eruv, and so you can be a perfectly law-abiding Orthodox Jew and still carry stuff around the neighborhood on the Sabbath. The Catholic Church forbids divorce, but it permits annulment of a defective marriage. Medieval aristocracy was heavily intermarried, so when you need a divorce, you find something in your ancestry that triggers the broadly defined incest rules of the medieval Catholic Church. You say, therefore, the original marriage was defective. We just didn't notice it until now. And therefore, you're going to have to cancel it because there's never a decent marriage, never a proper marriage anyway. So those are all examples. All right, let me say a little bit about embedded legal systems. We're not quite out of time. Examples that we're discussing are the Romani, the Amish, and the Jewish. Those are all cases where you have a group with its own legal system under the rule of another legal system. Other examples would be the present-day Mormons. I had a Mormon student who did a paper for me on Mormon law. Black Muslims, the Sicilian Mafia, prison gangs. I've got a chapter written by somebody else in my book on prison gangs, which he never quite says that he's in favor of them, but he obviously is. He thinks that they resulted in a drastic reduction in killings in prison. And those are all systems where they don't have the legal authority and yet are successfully, to some degree, enforcing their own rules. Simplest solution to how to do it is to get the over-government to delegate the power. So that's what the diaspora Jews largely did. And my favorite example, where it seems a little hard to believe, but at least my authority is, among other things, or was a justice of the Israeli Supreme Court as well as a scholar. And by his account, what you have a situation in Spain where informing on a fellow Jew, that is telling the authorities, who are presumably the Christian authorities, that a fellow Jew has done something illegal, is a violation of Jewish law. Doing it three times is a capital offense. Who enforces this capital offense? Well, presumably it's the mundane authorities, since they're the people who actually have the power to execute anybody. So it sort of looks as though you can get executed by the Christian government for reporting fellow Jews to the Christian government three times. And if so, that looks a little bit like the situation in Chinese law, where it is a crime to report your parent for an offense, even if the parent is guilty of the offense. Like a case where the over-government cares more about maintaining the authority of its under-government than it does about its own authority, or is more worried about it. Now, I'm not sure it's right, but that's at least what Ilan, who's my source, claims is happening. The medieval Romani had a document which they claimed was an authority from the Holy Roman Emperor giving them the power to rule, to make judgments of their own people, and we don't know if it was a forgery or not. It doesn't have to have been, because you have cases like the Jews in medieval Europe who did have that power in particular contexts, but they at least made that claim. Alternative way of doing it, an alternative, is to use the threat of ostracism to enforce the rules. So there is nothing in American law, I think even yet, that requires one Romani to speak to another Romani, and therefore if not associating with fellow Romani is a terrible thing, then the Romani legal system can say, if you refuse to abide by what our court procedure has said you have to do, we will declare you marame, polluted, and none of us will associate with you. That would be an effective sentence. However, how well that works, the point I discussed last time, depends on how intolerant the surrounding community is. That the easier it is to exit the community with its own legal system, the less power it has to use ostracism as a threat. And the third method is to use violent force to enforce your rules, but do it while staying below the radar of the official law. And that is done in different ways by all three of the Romani groups that I mentioned. All of them, to some extent, use violent feud as well as their other mechanisms. And it depends on conducting yourself in ways that make you not very visible to the authority. It depends on the reluctance of members of the group to call in the authorities on other members. And it may also depend on the authorities not really caring whether you kill each other and therefore devoting much energy to keeping you from doing it. Polylegal systems, we're running out of time, so I'll do this very quickly. Multiple legal systems in the same territory. A medieval Muslim city might have separate courts for all four Sunni schools of law, Shia, Muslims, Christians, and Jews. Muslims under Muslim law in Spain ruled by Christians for a while. Eventually they all got kicked out, but for a while that was allowed. German traders on the south coast of the Baltic in Slavic territory who were allowed to conduct their affairs under German law. The Ottoman system, there were self-governing communities of a whole bunch of different sorts. And in Wales, for a while, you had Welsh and English law both existing, applying to different people in the same territory. The problem is intracommunal disputes go to the legal system of that community, but what about cross disputes? Those are some examples of cross disputes. One answer is the case goes to the defendant's court. That's going to discourage litigation. One answer is that if it's a contract case, you filed the contract in a particular court, now that court has authority over interpreting it. Another is that cross cases go to the court the ruler favors. And another is there's a hierarchy of courts which say that Muslim courts are superior to Christian courts, so a dispute between a Muslim and a Christian goes to the Muslim court. Note that the U.S. is a polylegal system. Different states have different laws, and disputes do not always have a geographical location. So an accident in California might involve a car made in Michigan driven by a city of Illinois, and then any law professors in the audience can say more than I can about the complicated rules in U.S. law that determine which state law a case is interpreted under. But we know that contracts can specify what law it's under because all of us have signed contracts where it said, and a dispute will be decided under the law of California or whatever it is. And I think that's it. And I'm only a minute over time. Maybe a minute more. And we're all supposed to remember that we're supposed to go somewhere else next week.
Next week, Rose. Mm-hmm.